Hey everyone, and welcome to the first ever Downtime podcast. We're a brand new fortnightly podcast that aims to take you behind the scenes of elite level downhill and enduro mountain biking. We'll be talking to athletes, trainers, mechanics, and many others who are involved in sport to find out what it takes to compete at the top level and hopefully provide you with some things you can try to improve your riding. We're really excited to have Chris Kilmurray from Point One Athletic for our first episode. Chris is a trainer to a number of the guys and girls at the top level of both downhill and enduro racing, as well as being a pretty handy rider himself. In this episode, we talk about many things such as how he assesses a rider's needs, what sort of measures he uses with athletes to monitor their progress, the importance of grip strength and how you could improve it, the basic types of exercise and movement that everyone should have in their training, the importance of your metabolism and how to assess and improve that, and the best way to spend £100 to improve your health, fitness and riding. There's lots of great information in this episode, so if you're inspired and want to change your training or nutrition, then please consult a fitness or medical professional before you jump in. Okay, so without further ado, here's the Downtime Podcast Episode 1 with Chris Kilmurray. Right, Chris Kilmurray, welcome to the Downtime Podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, cheers for having me.
No worries. So before we get stuck into this then, it'd be really good if people could just get a bit of a feel for who you are and what it is you do. So can you give us a bit of your background?
I'm Irish, 30 years old now, so officially old or mature, one or the other. I've lived in Morzine in the French Alps, which most mountain bikers know, for not far off a decade now. I've raced mountain bikes for probably not far off 16 years now. Yep, 1999 would have been my first race. Irish Champs, I think it was, 99. And now, for the last kind of 6-7 years, I've slowly but surely worked my way into the world of coaching. So, more so on the physical preparation side of things, but definitely trying to kind of blend the physical and everything else that matters for performance together. So I suppose my tagline is that I coach push bike riders, and that's what I do. Yeah, so mainly gravity disciplines, downhill enduro, but anyone who needs to go fast on a push bike can get in touch, basically.
Awesome. And who are you working with at the moment? Who will people know that you're looking after?
I've got a long list of awesome weapons, like I always say. There's definitely been plenty of athletes who stayed put, so we've built a real good relationship. And then there's, you know, kind of a rotation of athletes as well for different reasons. A lot of people come and go, for amateurs and masters and different people who have short-term, medium-term kind of goals. So coach FMD Racing, so Tane Seagrave, her brother Chaos, Joe Parfitt, Jamie Edmondson, who's a youth rider, Greg Callahan, Katie Winton, Greg Williamson, Elliot Heap, a long list of awesome riders. Yeah,
awesome. That is quite a list. Brilliant. So
there's more on the list too. Yeah, amateurs, masters, all sorts.
Fantastic. So let's get stuck into this and see whether we can unearth some things that, you know, can help people and that people can take away. So let's just say I've been riding bikes for a while, maybe done a little bit of racing, but I've never really had any, you know, structured training. I just get out and ride my bike as much as I can. Where would you start? You know, what kind of advice would you give me to help me maybe assess what my weaknesses are, be that in strength, power, mobility, or kind of in my engine, you know, in the aerobic or anaerobic side of things? And then how would you go about building, you know, a program or a way of helping close those gaps and improve those weaknesses?
I'd probably start now, I think, with the experience I have to date, I'd probably maybe first off step away from the kind of mechanistic thinking of we'll improve these specific qualities and that will then give you this much improvement on trail. And I'd probably keep it a bit more holistic at first and kind of just chat to the rider about their experiences and what they do, what they want out of bike riding, bike racing, whatever it is, and start with that and get a good picture of how they approach riding their bike. Because a lot of people actually, they search for physical improvement because they don't enjoy riding their bike. But the reason they're not enjoying riding their bike as much as they could is potentially because of other factors. Now, fixing those factors could be physical, and you could definitely attack things physiologically or physically, but sometimes it might be other things to approach first. But definitely just chat to the rider and get an idea as to what they want from their push biking first. And then, yeah, strength. So, yeah, strength, stability, mobility, not in that order, in reverse order, would be the first place to look, I think.
So can you give some of those examples of the maybe the non-physical aspects or non-physiological aspects that, that people could be hung up on or could be struggling with?
Yeah, like why do you ride a bike? Where do you ride? How long do you ride for? What kind of terrain? What do you get out of it? What do you not get out of it? Where do you see your own kind of strengths and weaknesses? What do you want to race? What type of events? Why? I think the questions maybe matter less than the kind of chat, the conversation that had happened, the first conversation, the first kind of contact with someone. Even just the words they use, the vocabulary they use when talking about bikes, pretty quickly start to paint a picture of what the person, maybe not what they, you'd find out pretty quick what they want because they'll tell you. But what they want and what they need might be two different things. So yeah, pretty quickly you'd start to figure some things out. And a lot of people genuinely just maybe don't ride their bike enough or assume every time they go ride their bike, it should be the ultimate experience type thing. So the idea of, I think there's a famous strength coach called Dan John, and he has this notion of, it's not actually his idea. I think it was a Catholic priest's idea originally, but it was park bench versus bus bench workouts. And the idea that, you know, a lot of people sit on the bus bench their entire life waiting for that bus. So everything is anxious, everything's pent up, everything is a little bit too much stress on the system trying to achieve what they see as the perfect run, the perfect turn, the perfect day out, whatever. So I think that's where I'd go first nowadays. I'd just have a good long chat. And then pretty quickly you'd start to unearth, oh, I had this injury, I get low back pain on a long ride or a long climb, and then straight away you're like, oh, well, okay, you've probably more than likely got weak hip extensors and you're relying on your low back muscles to do a lot of work. And you start to unearth the physical stuff, but a lot of the time you need to figure out kind of the motivations behind why they ride first and the motivations behind what they do and how they do it, because that's what's going to keep them long-term in a physical kind of performance program.
So when you're putting together a program, then you're trying to write something that not only helps improve those three pillars that you talked around, but also helps improve them, you know, their mental state and the way they feel about their riding.
Yeah, because it's all connected. And it's like, there's no, you go out and do a particular interval session to target a particular area of physiology or a particular area along like the aerobic spectrum or your power time curve or whatever. And invariably, you're going to get more or a better effect out of that training session if the motivation and if the brain's in the right place. So if all the motivation's intrinsic, it's coming from deep inside, and you're not doing the intervals for anyone else, and you're not doing the intervals solely for the podium or solely for just the thoughts of improvement, the desire to drive through the intervals is just to be better, a better version of yourself. So yeah, a lot of the time, kind of my job I'm looking at now is maybe more so change in behavior than it is purely giving people sets and reps, because anyone can do sets and reps. Any dickhead can do sets and reps.
Awesome. So are there any like particular keys or hooks that you use to try and make a program sticky, to try and make people keep with it? Like, how do you approach that?
That evolves for sure. That evolves as the relationship evolves. And I think it's maybe the coach-athlete relationship that is super. So communication is the bedrock of that, and without communication you're kind of screwed, and that relationship is going to constantly evolve and change, and I think it's my job to give them just enough, but to always kind of leave the athlete maybe asking questions or wondering a little bit, but never so much that they feel lost. And it's just that autonomy. Yeah, so give the athlete what they need to consistently improve, but always with stacks of autonomy, so they don't need me, they don't feel like they need me type thing, you know what I mean? I'm just there to facilitate kind of everyone getting rad. The more rad you get, the better, basically.
So how often would you communicate then with people that you've got kind of at an elite level? Does it vary from rider to rider, or
too much with some of them? Too much. Yeah, well, I've got athletes kind of all over the world, so I'm on the full 24-hour schedule at the moment, because I got a stack of athletes out in New Zealand, and I've got a few more going that direction as well for EWS and Crankworks and stuff. And then everyone else is kind of based in United Kingdom or Ireland, that neck of the woods for now, or maybe Central Europe, some of them. So I'm kind of, yeah, constantly connected. But ideally, you get to meet face-to-face pretty regularly. So I travel quite a bit, little mini training camps, 4 or 5 days here and there, riding, testing, training. Maybe even if the athletes have suspension testing or team testing, and there's a few people in the same neck of the woods. I'll travel there kind of just to get to throw high fives and do some skids. And then once race season comes, my life is kind of mega, way easier. Contact then mid-season, in-season is mega easy because everyone goes racing, and I either go racing with them, or I am at the event in a support kind of role capacity. So yeah, contact is, the internet age helps us, like WhatsApp, Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, Twitter. I'm trying to think what else we use. I used to like have set rules in the beginning. I was like, no, we're only going to contact on email. And then I was like, well, we do email and WhatsApp because WhatsApp's really easy for sharing pics of food and sharing voicemail or sharing whatever. And then slowly but surely, I just gave in and and now we use anything and everything because it just gets the job done, basically. Yeah.
So you're on call 24/7 with these guys then?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, kind of. Yeah, I don't mind. It's good. It's good. It's good to keep up related. It's, yeah, it's the way it should be, really, to a point. I'm at kind of less than arm's length, but I'm never there, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. So you mentioned testing athletes. Are there particular parameters or metrics that you like to work with that help you understand, not only for your benefit, I guess, but for the athlete's benefit, how they're getting on in their training?
Yeah, we use all sorts of things, and that's constantly evolving. So there's maybe quite a few kind of generic kind of foundational measures of performance, physiological, what I always refer to as performance potential. So the physical qualities that underpin your potential to perform, because performing on a mountain bike's got very little to do with your physical, it's got a lot to do with your physical qualities, but it's got a lot less than people maybe imagine. So the physiological stuff is potential to perform. That's what we all say. So yeah, just stacks and stacks and things, stacks of wee metrics that we keep on top of for different reasons. And that's evolved and changed as I've got a bit more experienced and just got a whole, just different athletes to work with too. So we see what is genuine, worthwhile, interesting stuff to measure, stuff that gives us good, valuable insight into kind of the athlete's performance program and their potential and their progression as well, you know. And as well as that, obviously it's a sport where you get wild and you send massive jumps to flat and you snap some body appendage, so having metrics to go back to for rehabilitation after injury and that sort of thing is quite crucial as well. Do you want to know more? Do you want to know like all the nitty-gritty, what we test?
I would be interested to find out what some of these metrics are. Depends what you're willing to talk about.
No, but like, I always say there's no secrets. There is no secrets. I guarantee if I measure it, someone else measures it. I don't know whether people in the mountain bike world or the push bike world measure it, but I'm pretty sure they would. We do all sorts, like continuous monitoring. We use HRV, which is heart rate variability. So that's a reading each morning, 1 minute kind of reading each morning. Gives you an insight into the body's vulnerability to stress, if that makes sense.
Does that help you control training intensity kind of level?
Yeah, that helps us do loads of things. Way more things than you might imagine, and way more things than I ever imagined, maybe. Gives you a big insight. And what it is like, it's a window into the autonomic nervous system. So that's how your body regulates all its own ups and downs and all its own processes of making sure the body stays somewhat tip-top within a bandwidth of being alive. And with that measure, you can kind of get an idea as to what the body's able for in terms of how much stress it can take. So if it's not good, then the body's saying no to mega stress. So intervals and loads of barbell isn't really going to be most helpful, or stress of any kind isn't going to be helpful. And then vice versa, if you're getting the big thumbs up, you can go get wild, do what you want. And then you get those measures each day. So you get this long-term analysis, you get this rolling average, long-term trend of your HRV. And then you can base decisions, daily decisions based off the long-term data and the short-term kind of data as well.
Okay. How are you measuring that? Is that an easy measure for people to get hold of?
Yeah, heart rate strap and a phone app. The apps we use is called iThlete. It's pretty well known now.
Okay. And is it something that people can get to grips with fairly easily? You can just pick that up?
I think it's like €6.50, maybe £5 sterling to download, and off you go. Okay. Download the app, get your heart rate monitor, and do yourself trouble, basically.
So a good simple way for people to maybe at least start understanding how their body's responding to training and help them listen to themselves a bit more.
Yeah, basically, because it measures your body's autonomic response. It's how your body responds to everything. So if you have a fight with the husband or the wife, or you've lost $600 on horse racing or something, and you're mega stressed, the HRV will know.
Right.
You can't hide from it. It's not just training stress. It's all stress. It's everything the environment throws at you and life throws at you. So it responds to everything, which is cool, because if you're mega stressed about whatever in life, and stress kind of in the big global sense, not the mechanical sense, like stress on metal. Then if you're mega stressed, then the body has to deal with it. And if it deals with it, then its ability to deal with training stressors is pretty reduced. So then the app gives you good insight into that.
Interesting. Cool. What else are you measuring then?
Some of it will be athlete specific. So it's kind of like, obviously the sports, every sport we deal with, and then every discipline within that sport has characteristic demands. So enduro has characteristic demands, and downhill has characteristic demands, as does cyclocross and stuff. So they're the kind of specifics to the discipline and the events. And then you have the individual, which is most important, the actual athlete, and how they match up. So where they kind of, what we look at first probably is like sport analysis. Look at the sport, see what the sport tells you, what's the demands of the sport, and then look at the athlete and see kind of where their current capabilities match up and what the gap is really between the athlete's capabilities and the sport demands. And that would include like the ability of the athlete to deal with doing nothing on a Sunday waiting for the race run, that downtime before race run that they're not able to deal with, and they stress themselves to 100% maximum, and as a result race really badly. Or it could also include just purely physiological stuff, like their pedaling power over 6 or 30 seconds or 15 seconds or whatever it would be. So we look at the sport, look at the athlete, and then we measure stuff that we need to measure really to see where the athlete matches up to the sport demands.
So do you have ways of measuring how stressed a rider is getting before a race run, or how good they are relaxing before a race run, or is that something that's a lot more subjective?
Body language,
Eyeballs,
words. I'd ask questions like, how do you feel? That'd be number one. How are you feeling today? That's probably the best question to ask, and that'd be the question I'd ask. What do you think? Kind of let the athlete speak, because athletes are human beings, not robots. We all are human beings, and that's kind of the key to performance, is realizing you are a human being. And there's some stuff you can control, and there's stuff you can't control. Or there's stuff you should control and maybe stuff you shouldn't, that sort of thinking. So definitely we can see. And in terms of an objective measure to see stress, I'd love to have the ability to measure salivary cortisol levels or other measures of stress hormones that you'd get from saliva potentially, or from other measures. Saliva probably being the easiest. So that sort of stuff I'd love before, after, during downhill race runs or enduro day or whatever. But for now, financially, one of the biggest factors financially and organizationally, that sort of stuff just hasn't really happened yet. But we have done quite a bit of a lot of objective testing on different bits and bobs on race days over the years, from grip strength to grip dexterity to blood sugar to lactate, all that sort of stuff.
Okay, cool. And do you monitor that then over a season and look at how your athletes are improving on some of those metrics? Is it something you can consciously work to improve?
Which metrics? All the metrics.
Well, okay, let's pick one. Grip dexterity, you mentioned.
Yeah, grip dexterity, that's tough to measure. That's really tough to measure. You need some fancy equipment to do it properly. I don't even know if you can buy the kind of equipment you need, because a lot of the studies I've read about grip dexterity, the researchers made it themselves. But I've definitely used stuff with like a basic grip dynamometer. So how strong, how much force you can apply on the little machine with your hand. You squeeze it, real easy thing. But then you can modify those sort of tests in terms of hitting a specific number on the screen type thing, and see how long the athlete can hold that number. So test multiple fingers, one finger, no fingers, whatever, and see how good the athlete is at hitting that sort of number. And you get an idea into maybe how downhill race runs, enduro race runs, long, like a 15-minute enduro stage, how that affects grip dexterity, because dexterity, more so than raw strength, is probably kind of what's the limiting factor in your grip strength on a bike.
So can you, just to help everyone out, can you explain what you mean between the differences between grip dexterity and grip strength?
Like raw, the ability to apply to to apply force to generate force with the forearm flexor. So the muscles kind of on the inside of your forearm that bend your fingers into that nice shape you use to hold the handlebar. Mm-hmm. So the maximum number you can hit on that is what most people have measured in the past for bike sports. But the maximum number may not actually be an issue because you may not really need that maximum number in a downhill run. And how that maximum number gets created would change with fatigue anyway. So having an insight into being able to use the fingers in a more finesse kind of way, if we say it that way, to grip gently, to grip quite hard, to go gently, softly, on, off sort of thing is what you do on a bike. So you grip with the three outside fingers, you know, in different, good bike riders do anyway, in different different amounts, depending on the terrain, depending on what the you and the bike kind of are encountering on the trail. And then obviously the brake finger is just hanging out there on its own, so the thumb needs to be super strong. So we just get an insight into what the hand is, how fatigue on the bike affects the ability of the hand to contract in different ways. Uh-huh. If that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. So if you've got an athlete where you know that the either the grip, you know, the raw strength or the dexterity measures are lower than you'd like, what sort of exercises or what kind of work would you program for them to try and improve that? Because I think grip strength is...
Ride your bike.
Excellent.
I don't know. Yeah, I'd also maybe go for that via negativa approach at first. So as opposed to attacking it directly and going, right, grip strength's real bad. Therefore, we need to work on grip strength. We need to measure max grip. And then when max grip stops reducing, then that means we've won, which it may do. There's definitely a correlation between, you know, maintaining a high level of grip strength across multiple runs and not getting arm pump. But yeah, ride your bike, take the via negativa approach, which is maybe ride your bike, work on your hip strength, work on your torso strength. So you're actually supporting your mass with your legs, when possible, when needed. So you're not just hanging off your arms, especially on kind of steep tracks where you're constantly pushing yourself up off the handlebars. And then yeah, hit the gym and do wild heavy deadlifts and do all sorts, maybe a few unstable loads or lots of carries, and challenge the grip strengths dynamically with things like kettlebell swings and stuff. That's cool. What we do anyway.
So is kettlebell something that you like? You use kettlebells in some of your programs, or is it just one tool?
If the athlete has access to kettlebells, for sure. We always use them for different things. They're cool for because the weight's hanging off one end and then you have to grip the implement, it just provides a different challenge. It's like it's another tool to be used and abused. There is no best anything. There's just stuff to abuse in the gym, basically.
Cool. Are there any exercises out there that you think would benefit the vast majority of people? If people are trying to keep this really simplistic and they're just looking for, you know, one or two really good exercises that will help them out, are there any go-tos that you would say just try these two or three things and you know it will help you?
Yes. I probably wouldn't go down the specific exercise route, like the specific exercises down to minute detail, but definitely mountain bikers need to have pretty good command control of all the basic kind of human movements, all the things humans need to do. So that would be like squat, hinge. So hinge your hips, do some sort of a squatting pattern pretty well. Do a unilateral, like a one-sided, you know, squatting type pattern, which would be a lunge. Push and pull, create force in a rotational kind of way and absorb force rotationally. And there's probably a few other bits and bobs. People include carries, which is just kind of dealing with unstable, awkward loads. And that's where I'd go, really. The exercise itself probably doesn't really matter. But if a person can push really well, pull really well, hinge their hips really well, and do some sort of a squatting thing, then generally they move without restriction quite well. They produce force across all of that range of motion. And in those ranges of motion, to produce that force, they have to be stable. So you're kind of onto a winner straight away. Yeah, so we'd go with all the classic stuff, hinging stuff like deadlifts, RDL, swings, different types of squats, depending on what the individual actually needs, push-ups, rows, just yeah, all the classic stuff.
Cool. You train riders that are racing downhill and enduro. Obviously, they're still on a bike. Obviously, they're still riding, you know, technical, very demanding trails. But what are the main differences in the requirements for enduro and downhill? And therefore, what differences might you see in training programs or training patterns between those two different types of athletes?
Enduro riders will pedal bikes uphill. A huge amount of downhillers will do so reluctantly. That's about it. The demands are, they are quite different and very similar all at the same time. So the actual kind of riding dynamics, so piloting the push bike over gnarly terrain and getting wild real fast, is pretty much the same. And you'll see when the demands of the events, so say like a downhill World Cup versus Le Twil World Enduro last year, which was pretty much just loads of downhill, you'll see a lot of riders cross over pretty well. The guys who are capable at dealing with those sort of demands will do really well. But the big difference is the hours, it's the volume. World Enduro is really interesting in that there's no set demands yet, anyway, at least. Things are pretty varied, and you need to be a real versatile athlete to deal with World Enduro. So you need to be able to go out there and sit on your bike for many, many hours, pedal. Like the Irish World Enduro, for example, you're out on your bike for nearly 7 hours, and you're racing 7 individual stages. So that constant on-off of the emotional and mental load, and then just the pure physical load as well. So the big hours for the enduro guys, and even when you're away and you're doing like the lift-accessed enduros in the French Alps or the Italian Alps, it's big long days of practice and stuff. So the overall kind of endurance demands, the work capacity demands for the enduro guys are huge. The downhillers have a pretty big demand too on overall kind of general ability to ride your bike for 4 or 5 days solid, but it's a bit more on-off, and you really need to... The downhillers need to be really good at switching off to switch on type thing. They need to be able to flick the switch and get animal at super high intensities over short periods of time. Do so repeatedly, but in between doing so, recover quite quickly, you know, which is similar for enduro, but it's just the time domain of those demands that's totally different. You know, the enduro guys need to do it all day long, multiple times. The downhillers can really rest in between, you know, the big hefty demands of a single run.
Does that mean the enduro riders are generally having to do more base load training, so kind of low intensity, long hour stuff, or do you look at it in a different way to that?
I'd look at it a different way now. Yeah, we wouldn't waste people's time with fluff or faff, but we definitely manipulate metabolism. So go out for long, easy rides, like you just said. Go out for a long, easy ride with or without food. Eat certain types of foods at certain times, type thing with the enduro guys. To manipulate the metabolism, get that adaptation we want, so they do have that big foundation to go out all day and deal with being outside on your bike all day long. Yeah, so the downhillers do a little bit here and there. Some downhillers will need more because some of them have a really poorly developed aerobic capabilities when they start working with me first, and that's something that underpins health, and health underpins performance. So definitely we attack that if need be. If that gets to a certain kind of minimum level with the downhillers, you can search for improvements elsewhere, attack certain things in different ways, and still improve your kind of your aerobic capabilities across the full spectrum without actually directly going out for many, many hours. The enduro guys, luckily, you can go out and you can do a 4-hour ride and do 5 or 6 rad trails, go get absolutely animal with the boys or the girls, and get your, you know, a huge percentage of your base kind of cardiac output stuff, some people would say. So you get those adaptations in the heart, the lungs, and the muscle from just going out for easy hours in the bike, and you also get rad in between. So
is part of that adaptation you're talking about the ability for the body to run on fat rather than sugars as well?
Yeah, you need a flexible metabolism, and there's a little hallmarks of that now. When I start working with people, different riders, athletes at different levels, any level really, and they come to me first, and you'll start with a particular 3 or 4 different training sessions just to get some ideas as to what they do and how they like to organize their day and organize their sessions, which is kind of crucial. And I'll figure out, you know, pretty quickly, I'll be like, oh, actually, this person's metabolism probably isn't the best at being flexible and adaptable. And then that's when you go off down the testing route and you kind of probe. You probe for understanding and probe for better insight then, once you've got a few kind of theories made up, you know. And that's when we can get to the lab, or we can do testing on a bike, or we can just ask loads of questions. It depends what the athlete has available to them.
Is there any way that the general public can kind of get a feel for how their metabolism's functioning in that respect? Like, can you understand or feel anything
when you go riding that will indicate whether you're, you know, you have an ability to burn fat at the levels you're talking about?
I think if you had lunch or breakfast and you're not ready to kill someone within 2 hours or an hour and a half for need of sugar or biscuits or stick sugars in your tea and that sort of thing, if you're actually able to eat a pretty square meal with plenty of protein and fat and you know, moderate to whatever levels of carbohydrate, and not be absolutely ready to kill someone within 2 hours, then you probably have an okay metabolism. And then you'd go off and investigate, yeah, on the bike and see. I think if you're looking to race enduro at a pretty moderate to high level, you should be able to go out for a 2 hour ride, climb some hills at moderate intensity, potentially dropping in some big old dirty sprints or grinds up some steep stuff, shred some trails with the crew, send some jumps, rip some turns, pummel some rocks, repeat that 5 or 6 times, hit the 2 hour mark, and only then kind of start to think about being hungry or in need of fuel. And if you hit that kind of 2 hour mark and you're like, yeah, I might be getting hungry, I could do with some food to keep performance up or to keep my brain functioning well, then you probably got an okay metabolism. If you're the kind of person that goes out and 45 minutes in, you're not sure if you're hungry or tired or weak or you're just confused, then you potentially don't have the best metabolism.
Okay, and how would you go about that? Is the first step to do some sort of fasted training? Or
you could do, yeah, absolutely. I think fasted stuff works for some people, it doesn't work for others, and that's probably in a psycho-social emotional thing, maybe more than pure metabolism. And that's maybe motivation, intrinsic deep down motivations. It's easy to do if you want to do it. You could go down that route. You could just, you know, do smart training, go out and the big C is what matters, I think, for metabolism and anything in training. That's consistency. So if you don't do things consistently, you're not going to get the adaptations you need, basically. So go out and ride your bike consistently without pummeling in multiple gels and snacks and you'll be fine.
And can you help that adaptation along with your diet, with the way that you eat? Or
yes, absolutely. I think that could potentially be beyond some people. They may need help with that sort of thing. I think people tie emotions and tie down kind of dogma to food too much, and they're like, oh, I need to do this, I need to eat this, I must have this brand of supplement, I must have organic sweet potatoes 4 times a week to get the gains. So people can maybe not get the wrong idea, but they maybe kind of get the wrong things out of investing so much in food and nutrient timing and that sort of thing. But definitely, if you want to restrict your carbohydrates every so often to kind of drive aerobic adaptations, the kind of anecdotally just chatting to people and trying it out myself and with athletes, that definitely works. In the literature, it's in the scientific stuff in the papers that scientists and researchers publish, that sort of training has been given the thumbs up and the thumbs kind of parallel. Maybe works, maybe doesn't. So yeah, it's definitely worth a try. The one thing we do, anyone who's on the old 0.1 program, and the one thing I've learned is you probe for understanding. So you make a choice, you stick to it for a certain amount of time, and you see what happens. And that choice can be backed up with evidence. So you can go, look, it works in this setting for these people, so we'll try it and see if it works for us. And that's kind of what you need to do. So if that means riding your bike to work 4 times a week with no food and having your lunch or your breakfast in work, that's cool. Try it and see what it does for you. Simple.
Excellent. So if people were going to say, I don't know, let's say we've got a limit of £100 to spend on some kind of piece of equipment or a device or a monitor, you know, the kind of money that you could spend on a fancy pair of pedals, let's put that towards our fitness or our health. Have you got any recommendations on what you'd say to go and spend that £100 on and then how to use it?
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know if I could, like, I don't know if the money matters, but it obviously does, because if you don't have money, stuff's a challenge. I think if you're a mountain biker and you have absolutely no idea what you're doing in the gym in a strength training environment, and you genuinely have no idea what end of the kettlebell to pick up, you would not know what plate goes on what end of the barbell. You wouldn't know what a hinge is or how to squat or, you know, what direction to throw the medicine ball. I'd maybe go to a good old S&C pro professional, PT, strength and conditioning coach, whatever, someone who's kind of got a bit of experience near you, and drop some cash on learning how to pick heavy things up with pretty okay form, and yeah, you'll see some mega benefits in your body. Getting strong is kind of like life changing for a lot of people. So that's maybe the first place I'd go in.
Is there anywhere that, you know, pulls together a list of all the, you know, the strength and conditioning people in an area that you'd recommend, or is it just a case of getting on Google and seeing what you find?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I think that'd be country specific, and you'd have accredited strength coaches in every country, and that may or may not mean they're any good, especially for the individual kind of aspects of different people and sports. Yeah, Google, internet, Facebook. I think if someone has a genuinely good reputation and they're not pushing themselves and what they do on social media, and they seem to genuinely get benefits for athletes they work with in any sport or any walk of life, just normal people, then I'd probably go down that route. And you're not guaranteed, but you're probably more than likely to get someone who knows what they're doing who'll help you. Especially if you're coming from a pretty low level of, you know, foundation, physical fitness, strength sort of thing. If you're coming from a pretty basic level, I think if someone with a passion for strength and conditioning, someone with a bit of knowledge and a bit of passion and plenty of experience, and they'll get you hinging and squatting well pretty soon.
And any specific questions you'd ask someone to try and help understand if they're the right person for you? Is it really just looking at their history and their credentials as far as what they've achieved with other athletes?
If a coach takes interest in the individual and doesn't think that they're going to solve all the problems that the person comes to them with overnight, and they genuinely take an interest in you as the individual and don't say, oh, I'm going to fix this, that other person who tried to help you was stupid, etc., etc. Like if someone is just, you know, pretty upfront and goes, look, it'll be a bit of a journey, we'll see what we can achieve, and we'll get you moving well, and we'll make sure you're doing things kind of correctly and somewhat safely, and crack on from there. Yeah. So I'd make sure they're kind of taking interest in the individual, and get to maybe, if it is a case you're a mountain biker who wants to improve your sport, they should ask plenty of questions about the sport to find out what the demands are.
Good advice. Thank you. So the last topic then, I think, before we finish up today, I think a lot of people feel like the more training they do, the better they're going to get. And I think the more and more I read about this, the less I believe that. What are your thoughts on the importance of resting, and what does rest actually mean when you're training at that level?
Yeah, I think the importance of everything is massive. Like the global kind of view of a preparation cycle, program, whatever you want to call it, is pretty important. And that holistic view of everything has a relationship and a connection to everything else, and everything has a knock-on effect of everything else. So the black swan type idea of the small ripples in the system may have huge consequences. So I think if the coach has that sort of view, or the athlete themselves, or the rider has that sort of view, they'll already be in a pretty good place to make decisions. And it's kind of that decision-making that really matters. That's what I work with now, read about, think about, work with a lot, is how we're making our decisions, how we can be best informed to make good, solid decisions for different reasons. So yeah, obviously rest is mega important, but then all the other bits and bobs in the training process, like variation and variety and all that sort of stuff, is super important as well. So I don't really know how to elaborate more. You probably need to ask questions.
what does rest look like? Does rest mean I go for a gentle hour-long ride and don't get out of breath, or I go and dig some jumps in the woods, or what's rest look like?
That's a cool one. I think I said to you at the beginning, you know, the vocabulary people use when they talk to me about their training, if it's come to me first, and we do like a profile and we get an idea of what they've done in the past, what they need, what they want. And the vocabulary they use will be really, really revealing. So they'll probably call training working out and not training, which is what it is. And they'll see it as something, that's filling their time, and they'll almost get addicted to it filling their hours of their day, which is what it should never do. And for them, they'll be like, oh yeah, I had 4 rest days the last month, or 6 rest days the last month, but I, you know, chopped wood, went to the gym, did a 4-hour ride. So yeah, I think people maybe undervalue quality downtime, and that ability to switch off mentally, physically, get rid of the social media for maybe an hour, you know, enjoy a good tea, coffee, cake, I don't know, omelette. Enjoy something in life that's away from performance and training and your goals and your vision of success, and just chill out big time. And sleep. Sleep is like every coach. If you go on Twitter and you see all the strength and kind of performance coaches, they'll just be hashtag sleep, sleep, sleep. Sleep is king, though. It underpins everything else. So yeah, if you can chill the brain out and enjoy your life a few times a week and sleep every night really well, you can probably throw the kitchen sink at yourself in terms of training.
So that's Chris Kilmurry episode two. Then we'll do one on sleep, right?
Yeah, if you, well, I'm not a sleep expert, but we definitely can chat more about maximizing your kind of maximizing the stuff that doesn't seem like it's important, or maximizing the stuff that's not training.
Cool, really interesting. Thanks, really enjoyed that. There's loads of good stuff in there. If people want to find out more about you on the internet, where can they find you?
All the social channels. So Point One Athletic Development is the company, or Point One Athletic. We're trying to shorten it to these days. Point One because point one of a second, in case anyone asks, because that's what matters. So Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and you'll probably get a different experience out of each one. And then pointoneathletic.com if you want to like purchase some sort of a service or a program from me and have a chat or whatever. And yeah, you'll find all my contact details and on the different social channels and on the website. So if you want to get in touch and ask some performance related questions, by all means do.
Brilliant, good stuff. Thanks a lot for your time today, Chris, really appreciate it.
There you go, bud. No problem.
Cheers. Well, there you have it, episode one of the Downtime Podcast. We hope you enjoyed listening and found it helpful in some way. If you want to know more about us and for information on our future episodes, then you can find us at www.downtimepodcast.com or give us a follow on Instagram at Downtime Podcast, on Twitter at Downtime Tweets, or on our Facebook page, which is at the Downtime Podcast. If you want links to Point One Athletic to find out more about Chris, then check the show notes over on our website. Well, that's it for this episode. Until next time, get out and ride.